Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Of the BritBiz.com podcast. I've got with me Savannah James Bailey. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Now, you are a producer of TV and film, Fox Club Films being a prominent name in your company, should I say. And credits include a few shorts we've already featured on the podcast when we had Nev Pearson.
Lovely Nev.
Bricks, Ghosted and Lockin' have all featured on this podcast already. So we've talked about you, even though you weren't here.
Hopefully nice things.
Very nice things. Nev was full of praise indeed. You're in post on Amru Al-Kadi's debut, Layla. Do you want to give a brief synopsis as to what that's about?
Layla is the sort of culmination of quite a long, ongoing collaboration with Amru. So we did four shorts together before the feature. And the film draws from quite a lot of the themes we explored in the shorts as well, but it's a love story. It's a love story between a British Palestinian drag performer who asked to perform at this kind of horrible corporate pride event, turns it into this quite radical takedown, and unexpectedly catches the eye of one of the marketing execs for the company, who's this cis white gay guy. And it sort of sparks this beautiful romance, but that has to grapple with the kind of forces of identity politics and trying to work out whether they can overcome that to be together. And it's a very uplifting journey of self-discovery that's sort of very celebratory of what it is to be a queer person of colour and the like resilience and strength within that community and the world of drag and the colour and fun that people create out of hardship.
What was the kind of tipping point that sort of made you all feel confident that the next step was a feature film?
That's a really good question. And I'm not sure that there's a particularly specific answer to it. I think partly just feeling confident in what we'd done with the shorts and feeling like, you know, we'd practiced and we'd tested out ideas and we'd made mistakes and we'd learned from them and that we were ready for that next step. And I think also, growing that confidence of voice and feeling like the work we'd done had gained enough sort of respect and trust within the industry that we could see a route to getting a feature made. And with the shorts, we really did grow an audience, which I think was a very exciting part of that process for me. A lot of shorts I'd made before, Nev's a bit of an exception because we did quite a few together as well, but quite often when I was starting out, I'd meet writers or directors that I liked and I'd just jump onto a project and sort of service whatever vision they had and then you put out into the world and then you move on to the next thing. But I think with Amru, partly because we met doing the BFI Flair and BAFTA mentorship program, which is a program for LGBT filmmakers. And so we sort of founded our relationship off these 2 weeks of just watching so many queer films and talking about queer cinema and what we felt was missing in that space and what we wanted to say as filmmakers. And I think when we then started to make these films, we found because they were saying something quite different and they were addressing identities and issues that we hadn't really seen before on screen, that there was a bit of a cult following that grew around them. I remember one of the most surreal experiences. I went into a Dalston Superstore, which is a kind of queer club in Dalston. And I sat at this table and the table of people next to me were talking about one of our shorts.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, do you know Amru? And they were like, no, just watched it. It was the first time that I sort of, you know, you make shorts and often outside of film festivals, it's mainly your friends and family who are kind of supporting them.
Yeah.
And yeah, and everyone was so excited that to...
What a lovely moment to happen upon.
Yeah, it was great. And so, yeah, I think we just, the film is very much made with that audience in mind. And I think trusting that if you make something very specific to a certain community, that it has like the legs to travel beyond it.
Yeah.
And that if you make something that's authentic and emotionally true, that even if the world and the characters are quite specific, that the kind of wider resonance will be felt by a wider audience.
Brilliant. And what do you think is the power of cinema to sort of tackle a complex and nuanced subject like identity? I mean, it's something that obviously tabloid journalism has made a horrible song and dance about and really misrepresented. So what's the power of cinema really to try and sort of draw out some truth about it?
I mean, I feel like there's a whole podcast on that conversation alone. But it's many things. I think one is that, you know, when you see yourself on screen, you're sort of being given a moment in the spotlight.
Yeah.
I think it can make your identity feel worthy. It's like, oh, wow, that character who I relate to is worthy of this screen time and they're worthy of that spotlight. And so am I. And I think it also, by being able to see stories and characters that you relate to from that perspective of the audience watching the screen, I think you can sort of imprint your own lives onto it in a way that allows you a bit more perspective than when you're kind of trying to unpick what's going on in your life just with yourself and your own mind.
Yeah.
It's like externalizing what you're going through.
There was a talk at Sundance London, and we're recording this the week after Sundance London, so that's kind of fresh in my mind. And it was called. I think it was like Sex on Screen, The Modern Gaze or something like that was the name of it. And you had like an intimacy coordinator was part of the panel, you had a couple of directors, but you had an actor on there, a trans male called Leo Mejil, I think it is. It's a Puerto Rican Greek actor. And he was saying exactly what you've just said, actually, about the idea of when, as a trans male getting roles in movies, it's like suddenly you're representing something that you've not seen on film in, you know, you talked about kind of roles he was given before, which were very sort of sexless almost, is the way he described them. And then suddenly you're front and centre and you are the attraction, and that idea of being attractive in a world that you recognise you live in, but the film can tell a story of like where that becomes something that people can also, other people can see happening as well.
Yeah, and I think particularly if you don't see your identity represented all the time in everyday life, I remember, this is not film, I was obsessed by The Bill, the police like soap.
When I
was growing up. And
hard not to be in Britain. I think it was on every day at one point.
And I remember this lesbian kiss on it. And I used to watch it with my kind of childhood best friend, who I'm still super close to. And we were so excited about it the next day. And looking back, I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense. At the time, probably like 10, I couldn't necessarily understand why it was that scene, more than any other scene in the entire, you know, 10-year series or whatever it's been, why that gripped me so much. And then looking back, you go, oh, that was probably a bit of an awakening moment for me. And actually just being able to see that representation and it like opens up possibilities for what your future could be or what, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I teach at Liverpool Media Academy, and I shared with my students a couple of examples of when I was growing up, of sort of the way representation began to change, and soap operas being a bit like your Bill example. And there was in the mid to late 80s, there was the first gay kiss between two men. But I also shared with them the tabloid media reaction at the same time, and it was in 2023. It was so hard to believe the horribleness. And when you see the scene, it's literally a man kissing another man on the cheek. It's barely what you would call it. You know, I mean, it's two gay men, so it's a gay kiss, but it's not passionate. There's nothing overtly sexual that could get anyone going either way, you know. And the idea that this was the end of the Western civilization, the way the tabloid media were covering it, it's hard to remember a time when that was just an acceptable way to talk.
And I think there's such a kind of chicken and egg situation between culture and society, where culture reflects society, but it also shapes it. And so I know for a lot of gay men growing up, when pretty much the only representation of gay life in not only film and TV, but in you know, the papers and in schools, was all about the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
And they grew up in absolute terror that their sexuality was going to equate to death. And that, you know, if they'd had representation that was positive and that showed just normal people whose sexuality is just a facet of their identity and not, you know, doesn't equate to doom, because so often that is what representation has been to date. It's like the lesbian dies, or
the trope,
the guy gets HIV. Yeah. It's those tropes that really do have lasting damage. So that's, yeah, one of the things that really excites me about Layla is that we're sort of throwing away the tropes and not ignoring the challenges that still exist for people whose identities do face prejudice. And, you know, that's the complexities to navigate. But there's also the queer community is amazingly resilient, and people pull together, and the sort of hilarity and creativity and love and support is also really strong. And I think that doesn't get enough screen time, maybe because people don't think it's, you know, there's a tendency we reach for like the most dramatic stories on screen often.
Yeah.
And, you know, death and trauma are often quite good drama, but whether they are an accurate reflection of people's lives is another question.
Yeah, I suppose that's always going to be the challenge of film and TV, isn't it? Is that to be dramatic, you've got to be dramatic.
Yeah. But I think, you know, we experience drama in our everyday as well. Like, it's those, yes, you do have massive life events that really shape the course of everything. But in the space of a day, we all go through our own interpersonal drama. And sometimes I think actually exploring the kind of intricacies of that is equally as powerful as big, splashy car chases and,
indeed,
you know, life-changing events.
Indeed. Now, TV stuff you've been working on. I mean, tonally quite different. One of the shows you've done, which is the TV series Queens of Mystery, three crime-writing sisters and their 28-year-old niece using their extensive knowledge of crime to solve whodunit-style murders in the picturesque village of, is it Wildermarsh or Wildmarsh?
Wildmarsh.
Wildmarsh. Is that a real place?
It's not. No. I'm actually sat under the neon light that is the front of the bookshop in Queens of Mystery, which is like the precinct for the show.
One of the things we talked about before we started recording was just that notion of the idea of the difference between making films and making TV. So in very blunt terms, with those two recent experiences close together, what would you say are kind of like headline differences for you between producing a TV series and producing a film with someone you've worked with on four shorts leading up to making it?
I will answer that, but I also just want to say that, you know, they are very different. But at the same time, on the sort of representation question,
yeah,
I think one of the things I love about Queens of Mystery, and which something I've taken away from it, which yeah. I now try and do in a lot of my work, is what I call this kind of idea of Trojan horsing, where, you know, ultimately people watch film and TV to be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
And Queens of Mystery is a really, really fun, entertaining murder mystery show. But it's got three female leads over the age of 50, which is a complete rarity. Only one of the seven lead characters is a white man. We've set it in this like picturesque sort of bucolic English countryside village, mm-hmm. but have done it in a way that's like the England we'd like to see, and the England that maybe is truer to life than what you might see in the kind of exported drama that we often, you know, the Midsummer Murders and the Downton Abbeys, and which create a very kind of whitewashed version of England. It is different, but it's my Trojan horse. We sort of
I think that's a really cool a really cool thing to be conscious of doing.
Yeah,
you often hear criticism stuff that tries to be representative in the sense of it. They feel like they're being hit. The critics feel like they're being hit with it. Whereas if it's just part of the show,
yeah, and it reaches an audience that would never go to see Layla. But yeah, Amru actually has a cameo in Queens of Mystery.
Really?
Yeah, they're in season two as a sort of presenter at a, you know, local event.
Excellent.
And how often you can get a Middle Eastern drag performer in front of people that would never go to see a film about a Middle Eastern drag performer. So yeah, I love it. And it's a lot of fun to make. But to answer your actual question, I think the main difference that I felt is just the amount of time. And in two respects, I guess, making a film, or at least my experience of making Layla, you know, development is, it's really hard to get films made, and development can be very slow. And on the other hand, when you get into production, we shot for 6 weeks, whereas Queens of Mystery shot for 16 weeks. And the amount of energy you can throw into something that's 6 weeks versus 16 is really different.
Mm.
And I did really love that, you know, I think in TV, you just have to treat it as your kind of day job, because otherwise you burn out so quickly. And there was something quite special about the film, of just everyone's sort of enthusiasm and love for the project, and this sense of pulling together around an idea that everyone was really passionate about. I think probably my experience on Queens of Mystery was quite different to what it might be to produce other TV shows, because we did approach it in quite an indie film way.
Okay.
I mean, the format of the series is each season is three 90-minute episodes. So it's almost like making three indie features just at the same time and back to back.
So that's 12 weeks to make three 90-minute episodes. Is that what you're saying? You said 12 weeks before.
16 weeks.
16 yeah. weeks, sorry.
Yeah, I think 16. Maybe it was 16 weeks with 2 weeks off between each. So three blocks. So maybe 14 weeks shoot, but 16 weeks production period.
Okay, okay.
And that's really hard and takes a lot out of you. But there's also benefits to it in terms of the financing tends to be more straightforward. You know that it's going to be put out into the world. You sort of avoid the anxieties of, is anyone actually going to see this? How are we going to get it in front of audiences? You know that it's got that, it's on a certain date, it's going to be
available. I hadn't thought about it in terms of anxieties. You're right. Yeah, there's once you're off, you know what its place is in the world. I mean, apart from a studio film has the same thing, but a TV program that gets commissioned is going to be shown on that station or channel, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it.
Yeah, and once you've delivered it, it's sort of in the channel's hands, and
yeah,
you cross your fingers and hope for the best and do what you can to promote it. But yeah, I think the life of film is much longer, and yeah, the sort of level of personal investment for me in Layla is huge, because like I said, it's been a long time working with Amru, and it's just a project I'm so passionate about. So it feels very much from both of our hearts, in a way that Queens of Mystery is just great fun. And I love Julian Unthank, the creator, is such a talented writer. And we've learned a lot working with him, just in terms of he's got this kind of amazing clockwork ability. Like, murder mysteries are just pieces of mechanical clockwork, and he's so good at it. And I've enjoyed it enormously, but quite a different process.
Well, look, thank you for sharing those experiences and observations. We're going to move on to the format of the show, three films that have impacted everything in adult life. You have given me three films.
I have. I feel like this is basically just going to be a therapy session for me.
It always, every show I've done, if I'm honest with you, Savannah, so don't feel that you'll be alone in that one. And I mean, both, I get it every time I do it. And I'm getting it vicariously. But for the listener that's not heard this song before, Savannah's given me three films.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
We're going to talk about each film for 5 minutes. And when the 5 minutes are up, we'll hear this sound. And then we'll move on to the next one. Does that seem all fair and reasonable to you, Savannah?
It does. It's a bit scary. The pressure of the timer is...
Think of it as jeopardy rather than pressure. So, without further ado, and we're starting with Inside Out from 2015. Do you want to tell us why that is such a fond film memory for you? Where do you see this first time?
I went to see it with my dad at a cinema in central London.
Okay.
And so I before we get into it, I guess my confession is that my cinema history is quite shameful. So all of these films, you say changed everything about your adult life, but I think all of these films I've seen as an adult.
Impacted your adult life, though, so they can impact your adult life.
This was, I think I was 22 when this came out,
mm-hmm.
and I went to see it with my dad, and I have never cried so hard at a film in my life.
Really?
And I did not expect that going into the cinema. And
Pixar have a habit of this, though, don't they?
They're very good at it, yeah. But I mean, I've seen a lot of, you know, Toy Story, Left Me Cold, Up, shed a tear but didn't like have a full-on breakdown. But I was sobbing so uncontrollably that my dad was like, do you need to leave the cinema?
So what got you with Inside Out then that hadn't got you before with the others?
Well, I think it was just something clicked into place about my understanding of my own emotions, and the sense of relief that gave me was massive, because I think they'd up to that point maybe been a slight enigma to myself, and seeing it there on the screen, I was like, oh, that's, you can have this, it sounds so obvious now, but you can have this kind of confusing mix of emotions, and that's okay. And I think I'd also just connected quite directly to the character of Riley. I was similarly, I think I was 13 when I moved from London to Kent, from this sort of very like liberal creative world to this quite conservative small town, and spent a lot of those years feeling sort of like a bit of an alien, I guess.
Okay.
And having had this very, very happy childhood, I suddenly, in your teenage years, just all of these quite confusing emotional things hit. And, you know, at that time, it was a big 5 years. Like, my parents divorced. I was diagnosed with a chronic autoimmune disease. I was grappling with my sexuality. I had my first experience of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And through, I had, you know, some great friends through all of that, but still that sense of like being in this new place and kind of ripped out of this quite comforting childhood life that I'd had and feeling like an outsider in this new world. And suddenly with all of this like big shit going on where, yeah. And, you know, and Inside Out, it's like that moment where despite all the joy that's come before for her, everything just suddenly gets tinged with these complications of emotions and that sense of tragedy of leaving childhood innocence behind and having to face the sort of harsher realities of the world.
The thing we're told, it's always like there's always like this halcyon view of what it means to be a child versus being an adult. And I remember reading a paper about this one time where it was like, actually, we like to forget as opposed to that we know it happened, that childhood can be quite hot. You know, you described horrible things you said that happened to yourself personally, but just generally, childhood can be horrible. It's not so funny. We remember the fun bits, but actually, it's full of doubt.
Yeah, and looking back, I think I just felt so ill-equipped. It's like you're still, at that age, you're still a child, but suddenly you're kind of entering this more adult world. And just, you know, I think if I went through those things now, I'd have such a different emotional reaction to it. But there's a moment in the film where the control board just shuts down and she's kind of in this like emotional daze. And honestly, I think that was like basically how I walked through most of my teenage years. And those walls kind of went up that I think do it in a sense to protect that core inner joy. So I had, you know, there's a lot of joy that is in my life and was in my life at the time, and just that sense of like needing to protect that from the external things that are going on. But if you do that, you shut out a lot as well. And I have kind of quite hazy memories at that time because I think just was trying to get through it. And watching that, and I guess the message of the film is like, it's okay to feel sad and it's okay to feel confused. And it just like clicked something into place for me a bit that I guess it's important to like practice vulnerability and to open yourself up.
Indeed. The bell stops you there. And no, that's, yeah. I mean, I just have to ask, because if your dad was saying to you, you know, should we leave or something, is it you all? What was the conversation like with your dad after the film had finished?
I actually don't remember. I don't think that there was a sort of big, like, opening up or anything. I think I probably just left the cinema and he was like, "You're right." And I was like, "Yeah, I'm fine."
You've answered him like a 13-year-old.
Yeah, basically. It let it out for that moment and then I retreated to that place of comfort. But
brilliant.
No, it's... Yeah, it has a special place for me, that one.
Moving 3 years on from that one, we've got Love, Simon from 2018. Do you want to tell us how you got to see that film, who you saw it with, and why is that a fond film memory for you?
Yeah, so I chose this one because it's had a massive impact on the direction of my career.
Okay.
And I think I mentioned that in 2017, I was part of the BFI Flair and BAFTA. Yeah. And so around that time, I was sort of growing this passion for telling queer stories on screen and like having a lot of discussions about how to move those narratives forward. And then so the following year, 2018, Love, Simon screened at Flair. And it's just an extraordinary screening. Like watching that film with a predominantly LGBT audience and the energy and buzz and love that was in the room and continued as everyone left the cinemas was just amazing. It was like this relatively pain-free celebratory love story of these two gay teens, and it was in cinemas, and then it was, you know, when it came out, it was like on billboards. And that thing we were talking about of, you know, feeling, I think their tagline was everyone deserves a great love story, and that really in that room, I think that really resonated. And seeing it given that social space. And so around that time, I'd become quite good friends with these two other up-and-coming queer filmmakers, Lauren Dunn and Sarah Bacon.
Okay.
And we'd sort of met on, I guess, like film festival scene and networking events, and I had a lot of admiration for the work that both of them were making.
Yeah.
And so that summer, we were all at Edinburgh Film Festival, which was a couple of months after Flare. And it was at the Edinburgh Cayley, which, for those who don't know, is each year they used to throw this big, good old Scottish dance for everyone attending the festival. It was such a fun event. And we'd all gone outside to get some air. And we started talking about Love, Simon, and particularly about that tagline, that kind of idea that everyone deserves a great love story.
No, it's a beautiful phrase.
Yeah. And we were sort of just asking, like, where's ours then? Like, where's our joyful lesbian teen rom-com that we didn't get to see when we were growing up, and where nobody dies and no one's thrown out of their home or sent to conversion therapy or, you know, forced to endure these horrible things? And it was just a moment we were like, well, we're all filmmakers, so why don't we make one? And yeah, initially we kind of teamed up to find one project, and we put out the word that we were on the hunt for something that fit that bill.
Yeah.
We read tons of sample scripts and met loads of writers and just couldn't quite find the right idea that way. So we put it on the back burner for maybe a year. And then in 2020, we decided to look at books, and we optioned this incredible Australian YA novel called Amelia Westlake Was Never Here, which we set up for development with Work and Title, with this amazing American writer called Britta London adapting.
Okay.
And I think during the process of doing that, we just had so much fun and realized that there was an appetite, and we knew there would be an appetite from audiences because we sort of were the audience. And we were slightly surprised that there was an appetite as well from financiers. And I think people waking up to the idea that you actually, you know, there's a lot of value in authentic storytelling and not a lot of producers coming at it from that perspective.
Yeah.
And so from that, we launched a new production company called Teen Club. Okay. And now have a full slate of these sort of amazing, ambitious film and TV projects from brilliant queer talent. And yeah, teaming up with friends was like one of the best decisions of my life. So all thanks to Love, Simon, really.
Do the filmmakers behind Love, Simon know this trigger that they fired?
I don't know if they do. I think we did at some point approach them with when we were trying to set up Amelia Westlake.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think they do. We should write them a nice letter.
I mean, out of interest, from with you sort of questioning where's our love story and seeing Love, Simon and going, wow, what a brilliant love story. We live in a more progressive world than the one I was describing earlier when there was a gay kiss in EastEnders. But is there still some resistance to it in a mainstream sense, or
I think in a way TV has always been slightly more progressive in terms of what's considered
go on, finish your sentence.
In what's considered mainstream, because I think it can be one storyline, or it can be, and you can move on from it in the next episode, or you can get people to like the characters enough that then you can introduce that, and it's then you're not going to lose
and a public
them.
Service broadcaster has the responsibility beyond investors in a film.
I think there's definitely a resistance from the, you know, a cinema going audience maybe won't turn out for it. But I think we also just know how there's such an avid audience, and because people, you know, I think if you look at something like Heartstopper, which I know is TV, but that was immensely popular with the age group that it was targeting. But it was also popular with a lot of older queer people because we hadn't had that growing up. So you kind of don't have that kind of canon of stuff to look back on.
Well, look, let's move on to your final choice, which is just a couple of years ago now. 2021's The Worst Person in the World. Do you want to tell us where that fits in terms of, I mean, so far we've had you grappling with what it was like to be 13 and all the life-changing things for good or for bad that happened for you, seeing a film and how that kick-started a whole new offshoot in terms of what you were going to try and make. So The Worst Person in the World, where does that fit into the life of Savannah?
I suppose maybe it's just another like chapter. You know, those films that bookend chapters of your life.
Yeah.
And I mean, for a start, I'm a massive Joachim Trier fan.
Mm.
And I really liked Loud and Bombs and Thelma and Reprise, which we were talking about before we started recording. Yeah. And yeah, I maybe have less to say about this because I think it's probably still a bit raw. And I've actually only seen it the once, partly because I'm sort of terrified to ruin the experience. You know, when you have something that you love so much and then you're like, exactly, I can't watch it again, it might let me down. But yeah, it was a very profound cinema experience and also just day in my life. I went to see this at 11 a.m. On a Sunday at the Curzon Soho.
Beautiful time to see a film.
I was literally the only person in the room. And I'd heard a bit about it, I like the director, but I hadn't gone in knowing a huge amount. And I think I've never related to a character in the way that I did with, is it Julie, the character? I think she's called Julie.
Yeah. She's called Julie.
And I think the sort of sense of complication, which I suppose is quite similar to my experience with Inside Out. Maybe I'm tapping into a theme here. And psychoanalyze me based on that. But yeah, the sense of complication and of someone who isn't really sure what she wants from life, but ultimately has, I think, just a capacity for love and care and kindness, but who sometimes fucks up and gets confused. And, you know, I think she's, in terms of like, what career do I want? I studied biochemistry at university and before going into film. So okay. That I related to. I think she does medicine before becoming an artist in the film. Questioning, do I want a family? Which at the time was quite a big question that was on my mind because my ex-partner was really keen to start a family and I wasn't so sure. And what do I want from like romantic relationships? And just, I guess it's a kind of coming of age film for a millennial who's in their 30s. And I think it was particularly, I was having some sort of struggles in my relationship at the time. And seeing that film at that particular moment in time, I guess much like Inside Out, was just that reminder that it's okay to feel confused and uncertain. And I think I just took away from it this sense that whatever route life takes, it will probably be okay. And even if tragedies happen and things don't go to plan, you just sort of have to take it as it comes and try and navigate it as best as you can. And
I mean, this is you shouldn't be surprised to learn that this is a common theme with people I speak to on the podcast, in the sense of you go to see a film with like zero expectations and then you end up watching it and you go, well, this film is obviously written for me. When it feels so personal, even though it's a mass medium, admittedly you got the perfect treat, didn't you? Which is a cinema to yourself, which is emphasizes it even better.
Yeah. And I won't go into like the specific details of the rest of the day, but it did sort of, I think coming out of that film did give me a sort of strength that I maybe needed to address some of the stuff that was going on in my own life. And actually now I'm also obsessed by the soundtrack of it.
Okay.
It has such a good soundtrack. And I think it's my go-to if I'm now trying to grapple with those same emotions of like trying to work out how I feel about things. And
is that something you latched onto?
On, it takes me back.
Is that something you latched onto when you were watching the film? Or is that something you kind of discovered after the fact?
No, I was aware of it watching it. I went, got home and I put the soundtrack on.
Oh, okay.
And I think I listened to it on repeat for the entire rest of the day whilst crying.
But I mean, obviously we don't need to know the details, but it is, I think there is something about, there's the bell, but don't finish what I was saying. There is something about seeing it in the daytime and then coming out and you've got the rest of the day, which means it's the call to action, whatever it, for good or for bad, is there. Yeah. Whereas if you'd have saw that at 9 o'clock at night and come out into 11 o'clock at night, you'd have slept on it or something. You know, the call to action doesn't happen in the same way.
It really ate at me. And yeah, I do really want to watch it again, but I'm a bit scared.
Give it another year or two. Don't rush it.
Yeah. I think that's a good idea. Hold on to that feeling.
Well, look, thank you very much for sharing three films that have impacted everything in adult life. I mean, you kind of like the first one up that where it's been real time impacting in the adult life. I like it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the crazy thing is I was raised in a family of filmmakers, but you'd think that that would mean that I had a sort of great film education growing up, but I think my parents wanted to keep their work life separate as much as possible. And we never watched films at home. We did, wow. Our TV was in a cupboard and it would like get brought out to stick on a VHS of like The Jungle Book or something. So yeah, I sort of discovered films as an adult. Which very glad I did.
Indeed. Well, look, best of luck with the rest of what post has involved for Layla for you.
Thank you very much.
And I would love in a future show to have the director on to talk about the film.
I'm sure that could be arranged.
Superb. Well, look, it just gives me to say thank you very much to give your time on Britflix podcast.
Oh, thanks, Stuart. It's nice to chat to you as always.
Indeed.
Another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.